Well, Kim John Payne, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
In your book, Simplicity Parenting, Using the Extraordinary Power of Less to Raise Calmer, Happier, and More Secure Kids, you talk very early on in this book about the four pillars of too much: stuff, choices, information, and the fast pace of living. Tell us a little bit, just to start out, give us a little encapsulation. What do you mean by too much stuff, and what do you mean by too much choices? I'd like to combine those, because I think in some ways they're connected.
Well, the four pillars, as you mentioned, the first pillar is that of the environment. You know, like a lot of stuff in the environment, too many toys, too many books, too many clothes, just too much. The second pillar is that of rhythm, of actually strengthening rhythm and predictability in a child's life. And I find that by strengthening rhythm, the children just really thrive on that kind of predictability. So that's got to do with resiliency and having a child be strong and become who they, the full capacity, basically, of who they can be. Then that third pillar that you mentioned is scheduling and being really cautious about overscheduling, and the fourth is filtering adult information. A lot of kids are getting unbelievable amounts of adult information now that we never got, Francesca.
Yeah, adult information. You know, I think this is a quandary a lot of parents feel, and I know I felt it when my son was growing up. And that is, we live in a world that is incredibly stressful for adults as well as for children. And yet we want to prepare our children to some degree for the kinds of issues that they'll be facing. I mean, often I think, of course, about climate change, and I'd like to instill some good habits about saving water, for example, or turning off lights pretty early with kids. How do you strike that balance where you're not overprotecting them, but you're also not stressing them, and you are giving them some of the training or education or knowledge that they're going to need?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned global warming, actually, Francesca, because we can see, obviously, our planet, the layers that protect our planet are no longer strongly present. But I would also put out there that the layers that protect our family are also thinning as well. And so that those forces coming into our family from marketing, from media, from ubiquitous stress, from high-stakes testing, from everywhere we look, there's almost like there's an undeclared war on childhood. It's almost like the layers around our family are thinning. So therefore, in writing this book with Lisa Ross, I tried to put together what it is to actually add some protection, some buffering, so that our children can develop resiliency. Now, a lot of when people hear about simplicity parenting, they sort of might think about Little House on the Prairie or something, you know, like going back in time. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting developing resiliency for our children. And one of the ways to do that is to bring balance into their lives, is to have one third that is busy. You know, stress is not a bad thing. To learn how to cope with that is a skill right there. But that's okay for about a third of the time of a child's life. And then another third of the time is got to be what I think of as deep creative play. And then another third, the last third, has got to do with just downtime, just letting the kids be bored, letting them just hang out. And a lot of the problems with letting kids hang out is that parents have bought into this whole kind of parental arms race thing. It's like parenting is a competitive sport, if you know what I mean. And they're good parents, you know, these are well-meaning parents. And when we buy into that, we find it really hard to let our kids just have boredom, have downtime. And I don't know if you found this with your kids, but when my kids come to me and say, "Dad, you know, I'm bored," and I say, "Oh, that's a pity," and then they come back and, "Dad, I'm really bored," and I say, "That's a real pity," and they come back three or four. I get more boring than the boredom. This is just a tip: be more boring than the boredom. And within about 15-20 minutes, they're doing some of the most creative things that you can imagine. So boredom is the precursor to creativity, and we shouldn't be afraid of it. when I was in the Thai Cambodian refugee camps, what I saw a bunch of fairly stressed kids. And it was very understandable, of course, of why they would be stressed. That you could kind of get you could kind of get your mind around that. That made sense. But after I was finished there and I came back and I worked in the West and I had a regular family counseling practice again, there were just a procession of kids coming into my clinic who were just regular rascals, you know, different socioeconomic sort of groups and different ethnic backgrounds. And I was seeing the same symptoms. I was seeing nervous kids. I was seeing hypervigilant kids. I was seeing kids who were trying to over-control their environment. And that's a big one. I was seeing kids that mistrusted anything new. And that's a big problem with learning. And I thought, my goodness, there I was in Asia seeing a bunch of what you could call kids who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And here is a bunch of kids in the West who are presenting in exactly the same way.
Well, tell us more about what those symptoms were, because that was a very striking finding. What were the specific behaviors that you found both in the refugee camps and in London where you were treating these kids from the West?
One of the ones that caused a lot of trouble was the over-controlling behavior. Because when you're trying to over-control, when you're feeling your life is going too fast, too quick, and you then try and control everything around you, your parents, your siblings, your teachers, the playground, and that can lead to all kinds of really quite difficult behavior. And the other one, as I mentioned, was anything new. And that's almost the antithesis to learning. So these kids were in fight or flight, but they were also in freeze or flock. They were getting together in small groups, gangs, picking on other kids. It led to a lot of social problems. But it also other kids who were a little more introverted were freezing, were blocking anything new, were not reaching out to make friends and so on. And so I was seeing a very identifiable stress reaction. Only the thing about this was that these kids hadn't been through war. And so this was the puzzle. I'm thinking, well, you know, what's happening here? Why is this?
And it actually took you some time to take what you were seeing and figure out what it was. What did you come up with?
Well, you know, I looked at these kids' biographies and thought, you know what? They don't have any huge amounts of stress, but what they do have is cumulative stress. And that's what I wrote about in the book. The small stressors, and the problem with these stressors is that they are so ubiquitous now that as a society we've come to think of them as normal. They're like the new normal. Too much, too fast, too quick, too soon, too stressed, too sexy, too early. And what's happening is we're raising a whole generation of essentially neurologically damaged kids because of this.
Neurologically damaged?
Yeah. These kids are being, to a large extent, the part of their brain that is developing and controlling and in charge of a lot of their behavior is not the frontal lobes, not the neocortex or the prefrontal cortex, which is all our finer empathies and new learning and being interested in the world and reaching out and
Also being able to anticipate and organize and control impulses.
Control impulses is the big one. Delay gratification, control impulses, exactly. And have a sense of timing. Those centers are being inhibited by the tremendous activity around the amygdala, which is our ancient brain, which is our sort of reptilian brain, it's sometimes referred to, which is that fight or flight response. So having noticed that these kids were suffering from what I came to think of as cumulative stress reaction, it was cumulative. The difficulty was it was normal. And so I thought, okay, now what about if we just take the stress away? It's difficult to prove a negative, I know, but what about if we take the negative away? Now, these parents were coming to me as a therapist because I was often the therapist of last resort. It was great. There was just a big drop after me, so I could suggest kind of slightly strange things. It's a great position to be in. And I suggested, what about we start backing off some of the overscheduling or some of the media or what about we simplify their bedrooms and with toys? What about whatever it was, really, there was no formula, just whatever was causing them stress. And I'd ask them, what is causing your child the most stress? And out of that would then come a plan that we'd develop often with the most doable things first, the ones that were simplest and easily done and you'd feel successful in doing, and then we would start to work on the bigger ones.
You started with the more simple things, as you say. Probably the most simplest is the physical environment. Well, actually, I found this whole book wonderful, Simplicity Parenting, and I'm talking with the author, Kim John Payne. He has worked with kids all over the world in refugee camps and also in the United States and in England, helping kids and parents to simplify their lives. You start with toys. So that could be a pretty radioactive issue, couldn't it?
Yeah, I've got to be careful here that I'm not known as the Grinch with an Australian accent, you know. one of the things that is a really good place to start is to think about the amount of clutter. When we think about the whole too much, the whole concept of too much, we can start really practical. I mean, it's just a footstep into some of the more, I think, potentially more important issues. But the average child has over 150 toys. You know, they have hundreds of books, hundreds of items, garments, clothing, and it's just too much. It's too much stuff.
And what is really, I mean, aside from the fact that it might be hard to get through to your bed if you're a kid, what is the problem with too much stuff?
Well, let's take the example of books and maybe toys as well. What I've discovered was this. When the parents would start taking away the books, you know, basically just leaving out two or three books for a child and getting over this whole thing of books as being a sign of sort of higher academic cognitive development. The more books we can have out on a shelf, the better we are.
And you don't mean throwing the books out.
I mean throwing some or passing some on that are inappropriate, but no, I mean putting them away and having a library. And what we found is that the children, if basically to sum it up, if you want your child to have a lifelong learn of reading, give them fewer books for about 3 or 4 weeks, maybe even 4 or 5 weeks, and let them go deeply into it. I love books, and for that reason, we need to give our children fewer, and the same is with toys. One of the things we discovered is that in really taking half the toys away, and then half again, and then half again, and leaving a child with a small amount of toys. Some toys are very, very special, and you'd never take those away. But a lot of them are just plain annoying. You know, they're developmentally inappropriate. They're annoying. It's always the expensive ones that break first, but they cost so much money, you tend to hang on to them. And so by getting rid of those, the child's play becomes more settled. It becomes more creative. And the kind of toys that I found most parents were keen to get rid of, and I've got a bias in this, but I just watched the ones they wanted to get rid of. And then I watched the ones they wanted to keep. And the ones they wanted to keep almost always were the simpler toys. They were the toys that weren't finished. They were the toys that the child's imagination could do something with.
Give us some examples.
Well, some of these toys are just the simplest things. I mean, they're even just construction things. They're blocks. They are large pieces of material that the children can just turn into 100 different things: a house, a beautiful princess's dress, or the things that can have multiple uses. And that's one of the ways to judge, I think, of whether a toy is going to stimulate a child's creativity is whether it can have many, many different uses, or whether it's a finished product and can only really be played with in one way.
Mm. You also say that a lot of these kids really don't miss the toys.
No, not at all. You expect the children to somehow feel a little, bereft of all these toys. Actually, they start in all these years of doing this with countless numbers of families. We've just seen over and over again the children relish this. They relish the space to play, and they get right into that kind of deep creative play. Now, the same is true with clothes, the same is true with much of the clutter that surrounds our homes. And that's, like I said, it's just a foothold into some deeper simplifying issues like study, like being able to have downtime, scheduling, And one that we haven't touched on yet, of course, and it's a large issue for many parents, is that of screen media, is that of computers and television and video games.
That is indeed a very big one. I mean, as somebody who's been involved with Waldorf education yourself, they frown quite a bit on all kinds of screen media, television and, of course, video games and computers. You take a bit of a more nuanced view. Tell us what your ideas are on this, and how would you counsel someone who perhaps wasn't so married to the no screen media culture that the Waldorf education promotes?
Perhaps an illustrative story is best with this. You know, there was a mother. She was worried about the amount of screens, and she felt her son, he was about 14, she felt he was becoming compulsive about screens. So she brought him to see me, and because she knew my stance on this is to minimize and delay as much as possible with screens, and to allow the brain to develop, to allow the being of the child to develop. And so he was telling me, yeah, you know, he was making a strong case. He was saying, you know, like screens are everywhere. They're in airports, they're in gas stations, they're in doctors' waiting rooms, they are everywhere. And I said, really? Everywhere? He said, yeah, they're at school, they're in every classroom, all my friends have got them. I said, really? Is that everywhere? He said, totally, like they're totally everywhere. I said, okay, so your parents wanting to have your home as one place where there are not screens is really no big deal, is it? You know, and the look of venom that young man shot me. But I said, you know, what I'm saying here is that screens are a part of contemporary society. They just are. What I'm suggesting is, like anything else, we need to have digestion. Just like waking and sleeping, just like eating and being hungry, sensory stimulation also needs digestion. There are times when we have high sensory and visual input, as we get with screens, and there needs to be times of very low. We need to, in a sense, let our senses rest and sleep, just like we need to let our bodies rest and sleep. There's a natural rhythm to this. And so having a screen-free home, for me, it's just common sense.
What do you say to those parents who say, well, that's going to mean a digital education gap, that these kids aren't going to be able to keep up with the demands of the modern world?
The fact that they will not have screens in their home doesn't mean that they won't have a tremendous amount of exposure to screens in their life outside the home. Actually, and what it will do and what it does do is that when you have, just like if you were to suggest that in a way to keep up with work, that we never sleep or that we take drugs to never sleep and therefore we'll achieve more. Of course, no one would really accept that as a very intelligent sort of point of view. Similarly with screens. And then when the children do approach the screen, they can approach the screen as a tool, not as something compulsive.
In fact, you connect this screen, this too much screen time with addiction. Could you draw that out a little bit for us?
I was working with a group of kids in New York City once, and I asked them, because I often get asked to talk about drugs in high schools, and I don't want to talk about drugs, I want to talk about an addiction. And so I was talking to them, and I said, look, let's define addiction. What is addiction? And what they answered was this. This is what they said, and it stuck in my mind to this day. They said, addiction is an increasing and compulsive tendency to replace inner development and avoid pain and boredom and silence by creating outer stimulation. Now, if we really genuinely want our kids to develop strong ethics, strong values, to know who they are in the world, and boy, in this world that our kids are heading into, that's something we really, most of us, you know, or any parent, wants for their kids, to know who they are and who they are not. Not to be subjected to the swings and vagaries of whatever marketers tell us is the next thing that we should be to identify who we are. Now, we want that to come from inside. And the reason screens can become so compulsive and addictive is it's creating outer stimulation to avoid boredom or silence within. And what it does is it draws the children to identify who they are with something external to themselves rather than something internal. And that's serious.
In a way, you're really saying that far from being overprotective, you're being protective here, but you're really building the skills that they need in order to deal with the world instead of the other way around, which is, I think, what many people think, which is you're shielding them from the realities of the world and therefore they won't be able to deal with them.
Well, you know, Vice President Gore gave us this well-known image now of the frog in the beaker. He suggested that if you put a frog in a beaker that is just tepid water and it'll swim around, and if you heat that beaker, the frog will just keep swimming as if nothing much is happening. And if you continue to heat it and continue to heat it, even though the frog is now imperiled, it won't really notice. Now, what I'm suggesting here is that stress and fast-paced life has become so ubiquitous that we've been heating and heating and heating this to a point now that we don't realize that our children are, in a sense, becoming fevered. There is a fevered pace of life that is the new normal. And one of the things I'm finding is that more and more parents are questioning that. 10, 15 years ago, I was a little bit counterculture, to be honest. You know, I was a little bit wacko suggesting these kind of things. Maybe it's the economic times we're in where simplifying now isn't so much a choice but a necessity. But people are seeing what happened on a larger scale when it was just faster and more and more and more. And we're seeing what happened to our economy as a result of the more is better consciousness. And many parents are questioning, well, if that happened on a macro level in our society, then I can see many parents are putting the linkage together with, you know what, as parents we bought into that as well. And now we have to find another way, which is really a sea change in the way parents are thinking. The important piece is how. And that's what I try and offer in the Simplicity Parenting book. It's one of those books, someone said to me just a little while ago, this is a strange book because it's one of the few books I've ever read that ask you to do less, not more. They don't ask you to learn anything. This is asking you to, at the core of this book, it's about simplicity, but what it's really about is connecting to one's own values as they manifest in the family. It's about connection as much as it is about simplicity.
And along with that, giving children the time and the space to connect with their own internal selves. I found it also very interesting. You've been in positions where you've given diagnoses to children, and I get the sense it's not something you really like to do. We know that a lot of children are being diagnosed, more and more kids are being diagnosed with ADHD, with obsessive compulsive disorder, even with bipolar disorder, which was unheard of, you know, a few decades ago. You actually say that simplifying children's lives can be an alternative to medication in helping children who have these diagnoses come closer to a baseline of normal.
One of the things that we noticed over the years of doing this is that all kids are quirky. They all have their own individual quirks that makes them who they are. And if you have two or three children in a family, they've all got different ones. But what we found is that if you add cumulative stress to a child's life, then those quirks become their disorder. What I mean by that is the very busy child, for example, when you add cumulative stress to his or her life, that child can easily and quickly slide along a spectrum into hyperactivity and questions around medication and names that you've never heard before start coming up. And no parent wants to hear that. That is really scary stuff. And what we found is that as we backed the kids off, when we introduced cumulative simplicity as an alternative to cumulative stress, the kids became quirky again. They started moving backwards from the so-called disorder into just being quirky. But look, unexpected thing happened is that they didn't stop at just being quirky. As the parents kind of bought into this whole idea of just giving their kids downtime, not speaking so much in front of them, backing off screens, just allowing them a childhood, the quirk became a gift. And we didn't expect this. Let's take ADHD, as an example. We could take ODD, OCD, like macabre waltz of the Ds, isn't it? But what we found was that kids who were so-called ADD or ADHD, hyperactive or inattentive type, when their parents backed them off that and gave them simplicity, simplicity in scheduling, simplicity in their bedrooms, in their playrooms, simplicity with what they see with their eyes, what they touch with their hands, just backed it off. Those kids, yeah, they came back to being busy, but then their gift was this amazing sense of being movers and shakers, of being able to change something. And one of the things that I noticed, and with the team that I had working with me, was that it was a question over and over again was timing. Before, what they were doing when they were being sort of pressure being put on to for Ritalin or Adderall or whatever it was, they were doing pretty good things, but they were doing them at the wrong time, in the wrong place. There was almost a freneticness to what they were doing.
Even if they were on medication?
If they were on medication, to some extent it was masked, but the wheels are turning inwardly. And they're burning. That rubber, you got one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas. Mm-hmm. Now, I think of medication as scaffolding. The point of it is to take it away, is to move to a place that needs strengthening and then to take the scaffolding away. There are over 9 million kids on Ritalin in this country. In the United States, we consume 92% of all Ritalin that's consumed in the world, all these the various Ritalin and the likes.
Yeah, and one surprising thing, I know with Ritalin, they have found in studies that children may calm down and become more tractable in the classroom, but it really doesn't impact their grades. In other words, their grades don't improve. And I'm sure that there are parents out there who will say, well, you know, my kids' grades improve. But overall, the scientific studies haven't shown much improvement. You found with making simplicity the medication that they did.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that together with a dear friend and colleague from right here in Amherst, actually, Arthur Zients from Amherst College, we launched a study into this. And it was a pilot study, 55 children in 32 schools, all diagnosed with both hyperactivity and inattentiveness. These were, you know, children who were really, really struggling. And what we found with a simplicity regime is that 68% of them went from clinically ADHD to typical, below the 71st percentile. So that was you deal with all this data when you're doing this sort of stuff. Within 4 months, they'd gone from one to being they're still kind of rascals, but teachable, reachable. Mm-hmm. But what I've found though is that
not rascals, spirited.
Depends which side of the pond you're on, I think. Yes, but the what would start to happen is that the reason these kids would do so well is that now with a simplicity regime, what they would do is that they would still have this amazing energy and verve, but now they knew when. It was a question of timing. They had enough calmness in their life to when they then wanted to sense the moment. And that's a skill that is one of the most important skills in terms of what we can do to be successful in life. And this is the interesting thing with a simplicity regime, is that we want our kids to have timing. We want our kids to have empathy. But we want our kids to notice the moment, and when that moment is right, to go for it. And the reason that I'm so pleased with watching these children grow up is that I'm watching them grow up now into being really good mummies and daddies, of course, but in this changing economy and in this changing world, more than ever, we need kids who can be out there and not have to rely on the jobs for life anymore. They need to be a little entrepreneurial. They need to look about them. They need to be able to shift gears. They need to know to have a sense of when is the right time.
And yes, of course, kids who have ADHD are often very entrepreneurial, turn into very entrepreneurial adults. They are interested in many different things and are highly creative. And the timing is, as you say, often the thing that sabotages them.
Well, you know, likewise, with kids who are diagnosed with obsessive compulsive issues, that's the developmental shadow. Absolutely, it is. That's if you add a complexity to their lives, that pushes them along that spectrum. Their quirk is that they're just little organizers, but their gift is they can see patterns. They can see patterns within complexity, and with seeing those kinds of patterns, they can order things in such a way that is incredibly useful to any organization, a home, but particularly in the workplace. So I'm also concerned with the amount of kids who are being diagnosed now with Asperger's and nonverbal learning disorder. And I know there are kids genuinely that have this, you know, and really struggle with this. But one of the other things that I've noticed is that as you simplify these children's lives, they start to be able to pick up social cues. Because one of the great things is a lot of the kids diagnosed in this way can't pick up social cues, don't have it. We're back to timing again. Don't have a sense of being able to reach out into the world and see what is appropriate and inappropriate. Sometimes that's a bit off, that's not quite right with the children who are struggling with these issues. Just dozens and dozens and dozens of parents who have been trying this medication or that doctor or this way, when they introduce a simplicity regime, they find because their children are calmer that they have a much higher rate of actually calibrating their reactions and their actions both in a way that is no longer troubling to other kids. They don't think they're weird anymore. They don't, and so that's one of the things that we see across the board with most of these so-called diagnoses is that the kids become quirky, and then they actually uncover their gifts. It's a wonderful thing.
You also mentioned before the idea of filtering. What are some of the things that parents need to filter out so that they're not just there, right out there in their kids' experience?
One of the things that we're hearing a lot about now is helicopter parenting, right? Mm-hmm. There was a Time article magazine that I was interviewed for, which was actually the editors there actually pushed that up to the front cover a couple of weeks ago on Time, which shows you how topical this is. And one of the things that has occurred to me about helicopter parenting, and this is a little controversial to say this, is that, you know, on an instinctual level, I think helicopter parents are right.
Well, tell us, for those of us who might not know so well what this term applies to, what is helicopter parenting?
Well, helicopter parenting, it's a term that's been out there for a while now. It's about parents who hover over their children, and don't allow them space. On the cover of Time, it had the child being wrapped up in bubble wrap, not being allowed to experience anything of the world, being micromanaged. That kind of hovering, nervous, anxious parent.
So that there's something right about that?
Well, yeah. You see, one of the things that, on an instinctual level, that I think parents who are hovering over their children have got it right. Because if you look at the only other time we hover over our children, you and I have both parents, Francesca, many people listening to this are parents, is if you think about it, it's when our children have fevers. It's when they're sick and have a high fever, and we hover. And boy, there's a really good reason to hover. It's dangerous, and we're worried, and we're nervous, and we're anxious. So we hover. Now, what's happening is that I believe that society has heated up to a point, as I mentioned before, is that our children have emotional fevers. There's a societal fever going on in with our children and teens. And so we hover because we know that something is not right. Something is wrong. So we hover. But here's the thing, and I've been in the United States 12 years now. I know when you say, here's the thing, you've got to say something good, right? Okay. So here's the thing. The thing is, parents are hovering because they know something's wrong, but society is saying, no, 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 this is normal. And there's a disconnect. The parents who are hovering over their kids are being told what they're doing is normal. So on one hand, they're saying there's something really instinctually that feels wrong here, but society are telling me it's right.
Well, then let me ask you, is there a right way and a wrong way to hover?
Well, I think that we're right to stay close to our children in very stressful times. Remember I mentioned before, about a third of the time, I think it's probably pretty good to stay pretty close to our kids when they're going through exams, when they're going through stressful times in their lives. We will do that instinctively. So that's another thing about this so-called helicopter parenting. There is times to be close. But like anything else, it needs a balance, and there's times to let go. And when we back off this incredibly fast-paced, too much, too soon, too quick life, then quite naturally, without us even trying, it's not like something we have to try to do this. Without even trying, we can land our helicopters. You know, some parents have said to me in a workshop recently, we still keep the engines running until we're really, you know, convinced about all this. But they're sort of still on sort of alert. but quite naturally, what starts happening when we back out of that kind of stuff that society is telling us that we've got to do to have our children be successful, which is completely not the case. We are turning our children into what I think of as entitlement monsters, where there's this sense of entitlement. I want it, and I want it now. Very hard to delay gratification. We're turning them into little expert negotiators because there's just too many choices too soon. What starts happening quite naturally is, and this is the amazing thing, it's a beautiful thing working with these parents over all these years, is that the parents will then respond by saying, you know what, and we rediscovered our friendship with our husband, with our wife, with our partner. We rediscovered both each other and ourselves.
So in a way you're saying there's a time to hover and there's a time to park the helicopter, and in doing so reconnect with your own adult world. I think sometimes some parents may find, you know, that they're hovering over their children as a way not to reconnect with their spouse. So this can be a way to reconnect. But are there other ways of filtering? I mean, as you say, you talked about too many choices. If you wanted to give parents a guide on what they should filter and what they should let through, what might be some of the characteristics of things that are good to expose kids to and things that you might want to really keep away from them?
Well, let's use as an example what you say in front of children. I don't know if you're experiencing this, Francesco, but I'm experiencing more and more that the things that I hear, that I overhear in the supermarkets, in the gas stations, or whatever, wherever it is, or in the waiting rooms, that parents are saying to children just 15, 20 years ago would be unthinkable to expose a child to that. Only neurologically, we haven't changed all that much in 15 or 20 years.
For example, what do you mean?
Well, before I say anything in front of my kids, I ask myself three simple questions. Is it kind? Is it true? And is it necessary? Mm-hmm. And right away, about 85% of all I was about to say evaporates. And I think, okay, I'll tell Catherine, my wife, I'll tell her about it afterwards. All right, so I'm still going to say it. And then come the evening, we've got some time, I don't say it. It really wasn't all that important. And is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? Is a sort of a threefold filter that I run all my comments through before I actually say anything in front of my children. Because whilst we can point a finger at screens, at TV, at Game Boys, at computers, as sensorily overwhelming our kids, giving them too much information, which indeed is the case. The TV screens are just making our kids, not to put too fine a point on it, but just sort of aggressive, fat and dumb. Let's just say it. I can say this stuff and leave town, you see. But the the other direction it's coming from is adult conversation, and just not having that appropriate degree of separation between what our children should be a part of and what they absolutely should not be a part of. And one of the things, again, I don't pretend to be a parenting expert. They should come like with health warnings, like on the bottom of cigarette packages or something. This is just watching the result of hundreds and hundreds of good, brave parents that I've worked with over the years, is one of the things that starts happening is in terms of discipline. Now, the connection between discipline and withholding comments around children is a very interesting one, because when we... as Garrison Keillor said in Woebegone Days, I think, he said, when we're at Lutheran family suppers, all we noticed about the adults is they had large feet, right? Because they would look down. The kids would look down. They weren't a part of the adult conversation. They wanted to get out of there like a flock of seagulls and fly and play. Now, the relationship with discipline is a fairly simple one. It's a fairly obvious one. It's common sense. Is that... if we treat our children as equals, in other words, we let them take part in adult conversation and we give them access to adult information, then when we have to apply discipline, when something is not going very well or they've said something very inappropriate or won't do what we're asking them to do, and it's appropriate that they do this, they then see it as us pulling rank. They see the children come to experience us as equals. When we have a degree of separation in terms of information, on a daily level, we are saying to children, you are children, we are adults. You are 3 feet, we are 6 feet tall. There's a reason. There really is a genuine reason for this. And so that then when we say something that the children really do need to adhere to, they do need to comply, then the many, many parents have reported to me how much easier discipline has become in the home.
Now, I just spoke yesterday with another person who works with children, the teacher Rafe Esquith, and he also talks a lot about developing character. So I know some of the things that you've said here he would heartily endorse. The whole timing thing is something he also spoke about. One thing he says, though, is that you should explain to children why things have to be a certain way. He is a great believer in developing the rational understanding of children so that they can also make sense of their world. Is this part of this filtering, or do you feel that parents should just lay down the law without explaining it?
I think we go through 3 developmental stages, and they're very simple to get our minds around. I think when children from when they're very little through to about 6 or 7, that's the time of the benevolent dictator. No, I think children need at that stage to do something because we tell them to, and it's fair, it's just, and it's right. And there's very little explanation or justification. And I know there's a difference. Rafe would say there's a difference between explanation and justification. I'm sure, but we don't want to talk with children at length, explaining why it is they should pick up their toys. Mm-hmm. They pick up their toys because that's what we do in our family. Mm-hmm. That's just the way we do it. But so that's a little bit the benevolent dictator. But then there's a time. With our children, where I think of it as this is the tweenage time from about 10, 11 through to about 13-ish, around that time, where I think of it as being like a farmer. And what I mean by a farmer is that, you know, you listen, you watch the skies, you watch the earth, you listen to your kids. You'll be willing to listen to them about what they want to do and why, and sit quietly and let them make their case. But then the adult decides. You decide. And then there's the final stage of the teenage years, which is like the shepherd. And I think that's a time when you decide together. occasionally a parent of any teenager will tell you that they have had to decide. They really have had to put their foot down. But for the most part, you're shepherding. You know the dangers ahead, and you're trying to help there. But ultimately, a 16, 17-year-old is going to make some decisions. Now, if you think about that, then also as those three phases, birth to about 6 or 7, 6 or 7 to about 13, 14 through, you know, the late teens, you're also increasingly giving children choices. So children have very few choices when they're little. You know, do you want a red bucket or a yellow bucket to take to the beach? Of course. I don't want to be silly about it, but very, very few choices. It makes children feel safe and secure that their mummy and their daddy or whoever it is looking after them and knows best. But that's not going to hold through to about 9 or 10 years old. You really need to listen. So therefore, a few more choices are allowed to be made, or at least the case is allowed to be made. But then in the teens, lots of choices. As a society, though, we've got that back to front. We give our children way too many choices, way too young. And so they're like little Enron executives or ING executives. They don't do what is right. They do what is advantageous. Mm-hmm. It turns them into what we call in Australia little bush lawyers, and where they will negotiate everything. And if we try and give them choices and we manage their choices, if we set ourselves up as the management for little children, they will unionize, right? But then what happens is that when they're 14. And they make and they're used to making all kinds of choices about what they can do, and we're getting really worried about them, then we want to pack those choices back up again. Then we want to put that genie back into the bottle, and it ain't going. You see, so we've got it back to front. I would say we give our children choices in three distinct phases.
You also talk in the book, Kim John Payne, you talk in your book, Simplicity Parenting, about predictability. And it seems that this, what you've just been speaking about, has something to do with that. How does predictability help to give our children resilience? How does it help them to grow into who they are?
You know, it's a really lucky child who can say when a visitor comes to the house, "This is what we do in our family. We do such and such. We do this. We do that." There's a we there. Mm-hmm. There's a feeling of I am safe in my family. We do things in this way. Therefore, I am safe in the world. For a young child, mm-hmm. the world is their family, if we can make it that. And out of that we, this is the crucial thing, is that out of that sense of we, or what builds that sense of we, is rhythm. It's rhythm and predictability. Children thrive on rhythm and predictability, only we're living in a society that is so over-scheduling our children mm-hmm. that most of the rhythms have either gone, been blasted, or the rhythms, the only rhythms our children really experience are rhythms outside the home. Mm-hmm. The ballet lesson, the music lesson. It's like ballet on Monday and soccer on Tuesday and coaching on Thursday and probably some kind of therapy on Friday to cope with it all, right? But they may have regular dance classes, regular soccer teams, and so on and so on. What I'm suggesting is that whilst that's okay, that's fine, it's second best, it's even third best to the rhythms that can be established in the home. Because out of the rhythms that you establish, that's how a child actually will come to sense who they are. So the we do becomes the I am. And let me explain about the I am. When a child has a sense of this is what we do, as they grow older, they'll break away from that. That's normal. That's natural. We want them to, in a funny old way. But then when they get into their teens, they actually have a foundation of the we do, the we are, to build their sense of who they are. That's the I am, and who they are not. So when those temptations of teenage life come, when the drugs come, when the things that we really hold our breath and kind of hope that our children can navigate, if we've given them a really strong sense of our family values, which are embedded in rhythm, then they will make far better choices as teens. And I've seen that happen over and over and over.
Kim John Payne, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is Simplicity Parenting, Using the Extraordinary Power of Less to Raise Calmer, Happier, and More Secure Kids.
Thank you so much, Francesca. What a pleasure. Francesca Klebel.
Okay.
One of the things that's been happening all over the country is that I'll often finish giving a talk or chatting with someone like you. It's just always so enjoyable. But people will ask me, so what can we do? What can we do? And one of the things that we've begun to set up are these grassroots groups, support groups, these simplicity parenting groups. We call them discussion groups, but they're kind of like just support groups so that people who want to simplify can find other people who are doing that and gain strength through meeting them. And so out of our center, what we're doing is that we are facilitating and training discussion group leaders. And then we're also training simplicity parenting coaches who can work one-to-one with parents as well. And people can find more information about that on www.simplicityparenting.com, and you can go right to the coaching resources section there, and you'll see other groups that have established all over the country. And you'll see ways in which you can find just locally others who might be thinking along similar lines to you.
That's wonderful. Okay, you said there were two things. Okay,
and writing this book with Lisa Ross, you know, I know you're very interested in writing, and you can probably see this is an unusually beautiful and lyrical writing that Lisa's been able to bring to this book. I was able to meet with Lisa over many months, and what she was able to craft in this book, I think is just a really sensitive piece and a beautiful piece of writing from a parent to a parent.
That's so nice. Thanks again. And we will link to your website and to the Simplicity Parenting website at writersvoice.net.